Good evening, you're listening to Conscious Living Radio on Co-op Radio Station 100.5 FM. My name is Andrew Resmer.
And I'm Tasha Sims. Welcome to the show. Tonight, Dr. Mari K. Swingle, PhD, she's a neurotherapist, also certified in EMDR, EFT, cranial sacral therapy, and she practices as a registered clinical counselor and clinician at the Swingle Clinic here in Vancouver. She specializes in anxiety, depression, trauma, OCD, and addiction, and is also known for her work with families and children experiencing behavioral and learning difficulties and dynamics that can arise in a family with a child with challenges, including parental fatigue and couple dynamics. Dr. Mari speaks regularly on the topic of technology, societal shifts, and mental health. She's the author of iMinds, How Our Cell Phones, Computers, Gaming, and Social Media Are Changing Our Brains, Our Behavior, and the Evolution of Our Species. And that's our topic for tonight. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
So I understand for years now, some years, that you've noticed a trend that you call interference when you've been working with people who have been exposed to these digital devices or using them excessively. And I just wonder what you observed, how you came to begin, how you even began this work. Like, what was it you started to see?
It was essentially a clinical epiphany. I was working with a lot of clients, and not to pound my chest too much, but have a really, really good success rate with clients. And then there just seemed to be more and more clients that weren't, they were getting better and then would regress, or they just weren't making much progress with the, I don't want to say standard treatments, but with treatments that had really, really good track record. And I was scratching my head a little bit about what was happening. And it wasn't just one or two people. It was, you know, larger numbers. And that's where the epiphany came in, that we had what I now refer to as digital interference. So essentially, excessive use of screen-based technologies were contributing, if not causing, the ailments for which they were seeking psychological services. So these are anxiety, depression, insomnia, sexual dysfunction in adults, and a whole plethora of learning disabilities and conduct disorders or emotional deregulation in children. But the catch was, it wasn't on the radar. I have a couple of vignettes in the book that really speak to this, a couple of stories of clients and essentially the discovery process. And this would have been around the turn of the century.
Wow. And how do you work at the Swingle Clinic? I know that you map brains and you can actually look at the different brain waves. So you had this idea, and then how did you move towards mapping it over? Like, did you actually begin to do some research in all this?
Absolutely. Timelines were really interesting. I happened to be working, doing my PhD at the time, and I was looking at a topic for a doctoral dissertation. And I wanted to look at ADD or ADHD. And for whatever reason, things just weren't working out in terms of what I wanted to do. And second epiphany of sorts, it's like, hey, why don't I look at this very, very real clinical issue? And I never turned back. What I started to see once I really looked at the issue was mind-boggling. And this never made it into the dissertation, but I continued the research long after the PhD. But what I saw on the brain mappings, and these are on full 19-site EEGs, was an alteration in brain waves that we were seeing before, strangely, in those who use marijuana excessively, in certain forms of absent seizures, and in toxic exposure. So again, lots of head scratching going on here. And
can you just break that down a little more layman terms? What would we see in someone who had, first of all, because you're paralleling it with people who are using cannabis and What was the other one?
Certain forms of absence seizures.
Yeah.
Okay. And exposure to toxicity.
There we
so,
go. So what do you,
those are a lot of contractors, for example, who have had excess exposure to glues or painters with Varsol, things like this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So essentially, foreign... if you want to put the forms of toxicity that are coming into the brain. But again, I really had no idea as to what I was actually seeing, except I was seeing something different. And that's where I started to fully launch in. And what I was seeing was an excessive spindling of alpha. Now, in the media, alpha is touted for all kinds of things, but the easiest way to explain alpha is it's a measure of brain efficiency. And what I was seeing and what all of the other things have in common with what I was seeing is we were having an attack on brain efficiency. I guess that's the easiest way to put it.
And where are the alpha waves located in the brain? Are they in a particular location?
Thank you for that question. It's absolutely critical. And it's going to be very, very hard for me to explain all of this in just, you know, a few lines. But bottom line, where alpha is, what area of the brain is supposed to govern versus where it should not be, in amplitudes or in proportion to other waves and under specific conditions changes everything. So when you talk about alpha in general, it's kind of hard. But what I was seeing were waves that were showing that it was reduced efficiency. One of the very strong connections I found was a form of high frontal alpha, which is commonly associated with a certain form of ADD. And this tends to be the absent type of excessive brain chatter form of ADD. But what I found universally in my research was the association with hyperarousal. So this type of brain chatter, again, is a form of hyperarousal.
I have so many questions because when I hear you say that, I immediately think about that self-talk, that critical voice. Would that be in the same area or are you talking about something different?
Yes.
Something different?
No, this is in the same area.
Same thing. Mm-hmm. So it seems that with meditation and with a lot of the ideas these days, it's to calm that down would be a good thing. One would assume calming that down, that self-talk, that those in that location would be a good thing.
Absolutely. But here's our modern catch-22. Mm-hmm. When the brain is chattering that loud, you can't just flip a switch. And in fact, for many, trying to meditate is a form of torture because there's no such thing as brain silence. So for many, I counsel them if they do want to go that route, they need to do forms of meditation with mantras or something.
So you're substituting
yeah.
as opposed to doing just nothing. Because trying mm-hmm. to, trying, the word trying and nothing actually don't go together very well.
No.
Okay, but back to what you were observing. Mm-hmm. And can you tie it back to what we were talking about? So the waves, you notice them in the front part of the brain, and that's when people were doing, you're again saying cannabis or toxicity in some way, or epileptic.
I hate to confess, I think I've lost you and probably the audience already. Again, okay. This is the danger of alpha. It really depends on where. The first place I saw this was in the occiput. So this is the back of the brain. And this is the region of the brain that's responsible in large for quieting. And when we close our eyes, we want alpha to come up by a certain proportion. And that's very, very positive. But when it comes up in large proportions, there's a crossover point. And that is the signature that I now look for, which is in my books, I'm going to say correlated, not even associated, with excessive applications of screen-based technologies.
And so trauma, is that not also associated with the back part of the brain? Is it?
Interesting that you mention that. One of the ways that we can see whether a person has been exposed to trauma or some form of extreme emotional stressor
yeah.
is that alpha does not spike when we close our eyes. So you can see the complexity of all of
yeah.
this.
The yeah. variables are just wild. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hence 20 years of study.
Yeah. So let's put it in terms that can be helpful to our listeners. So mm-hmm. there you are. And I want to just stay personal if we can, because I always mm-hmm. find that that'll be the most accessible
yes.
route. Yeah. So, okay, you've noticed this pattern in your clients. You're starting to see a correlation in how their brains are mapping. Mm-hmm. And then you're going, and these are people who are excessively using things like computers, cell phones, gaming, mm-hmm. and video, whatever it is, digital appliances.
Yes.
Then what? So there you go. Now what?
Well, the first is to get the person on board. And this was a major issue years back. Again, it was not on the personal radar, it was not on the parental radar, and it was not on the clinical radar. So again, having individuals understand that their excessive usage is problematic, like any excessive application or usage of anything. So, I mean, we can compare to alcohol, we can compare to cocaine, we can compare to heroin, we can compare to food. And I always stick with the food yeah. because this is very, very important. We live in the digital era. We're not going to remove this, nor should we. Mm-hmm. One of the things I talk about when I lecture is iTech is not all bad. We cannot blame it mm-hmm. all on iTech. Mm-hmm. It's the excessive consumption. So just like food, individuals who overconsume, put in the category of the morbidly obese, what you need to do is learn how to moderate the behavior, mm-hmm. moderate the consumption. And so you can have your chocolate cake, but not 5 cakes a day.
And I would think one of the warning signs would be, who hasn't this happened to? You leave your phone, you forget your phone somewhere, mm-hmm. and what sets in that moment? For most people, right? It's like,
yeah,
I'm naked or something. Something's missing, right? Yeah. It's fascinating to watch. Yeah. I don't know if you went through a withdrawal yourself, or you, if you were always kind of
well, land
aware
of confessions. I've always prided myself on boundaries, and you know, the therapist practice what you preach. And I've left my phone at home, and I've gone, and I want to go back. And yeah. I say, no, this is a perfect opportunity yeah. to prove that you can do this. Yeah. So I'm just like the rest of us. I again, in the end of the book, I give some outlines of what I think are healthy boundaries for people to have. I have my own, and that I don't respond to emails after a certain hour of night on the weekend. But of course I break that rule. If I have a very important presentation or case in point, an interview, or there's just some sort of correspondence that makes sense to respond to, I will follow through and break my own rules. But I always try and keep them as front and center as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. It is so easy to let this take us over. And I am not going to pretend that I am above it myself.
Mm-hmm. It is easy to see where overconsumption of alcohol or drugs or food is, because we can see the effect of that right away. What is overconsumption of digital equipment, especially for children? And because the effect is not noticeable right away. You can see it in the brain, but average person cannot.
It really depends on the individual. And one of the things that I've made essentially a professional mission of is promoting, I call it health and happiness in the digital age. Exactly what you said. How can you tell when the usage turns dark? The two terms I coin are interference versus integration. So bottom line is, if your usage is integrated in modern life and it doesn't supersede or replace a developmental stage or positive aspects of interpersonal relationships, then you're fine. If there's an override, then you have a problem. Again, I go into detail in the book. Now, that applies to, I'd say, older children and adults. I am very, very concerned, however, with the override and development of very young children. And I will get on my soapbox and bang on my drum about this, that it's altering development at its core. The key example is of adopted children who were not caretaken or cared for in early childhood and what we have seen in their brains and their development thereafter. That's exactly what's happening when we introduce screen-based technology to young. So specifics on this. If we look at some of the children out of some of the Slavic orphanages in the 80s and 90s, and then even current day or over the past 10 years, the little girls out of orphanages in China, if children were not tickled, played with, snuggled, held, talked to, cooed to, sung to, etc. in early childhood, certain areas, essentially pathways that are designed to engage and develop through caretaker interaction do not engage. And we literally are changing brain development. This has gross implications in terms of how people relate to people. And I can go on ad nauseum about this if people are interested. But it doesn't end there. We're seeing some really interesting emergent research. And one of the studies that I speak to very often was a group of, I apologize, it was either fifth or sixth graders, but young children. They were put on a screen hiatus only for 3 days. So essentially they took a group of kids, divided it in two. One half was asked to just use all of their iTech the way they usually did. So it wasn't overly controlled. And of course, it's really hard to do that. So we just had essentially classic consumption on one group. On the other group, there was a complete hiatus for the 3 days. And then they compared the two groups. What they found was that the group who had not had any connection with screen-based devices for 3 days had increased facial recognition of facial cues, meaning they could recognize facial expressions. My greatest fear of what I'm seeing in the generalized population now of children are autistic-like characteristics in children without autism. Primary symptoms of which are inability to recognize emotions and facial cues and attachment to objects instead of people.
Hmm. So to be specific for those listeners who have kids right now, and they are asking themselves the question, when should I introduce stream-based technology, for how much, how long in a day? And I do understand that it varies because it depends on the engagement that this child is experiencing in other forms of or other times. But I remember you were very specific during your presentation a couple of weeks ago when we met for the first time, that there is a specific period of time that you would not introduce any form of stream technology.
Yeah. Let me preface this. With the longer I work and research this, the more conservative I get. And my age is six. The reason for this is essentially up till six, major development is occurring. You know, 0 to 3 is attachment, and then certain forms of cognitive and creative development from 3 to 6. The other reason why 6 is this is about the time that children are able to differentiate reality from fantasy. And if you need any confirmation of this, look at the age that historically children discovered that the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus were not real. Essentially, they can't...
They're not real?
Are you over six yet? Yeah. Yeah, so in terms of the effects that screen-based technology, the messages and the development that it can affect... 6 is a really a good age. A great concern of mine now is a practice I call fear-mongering. I mean, there's no other way to put it. There are lots and lots of news feeds, etc. now, putting fear into parents that if you do not expose your children to technology early, they will somehow miss out. I cannot say what a fallacy this is. Children pick up very, very quickly. They will miss out on addiction components, yes. They will miss out on being programmed. Sorry, I might be getting a little severe here. But in terms of learning to use a tool, they will not miss out on any of that. They won't miss out on the development of their thumbs or their index fingers, appropriate for tapping and texting and the like.
Mm-hmm. And you actually believe that the gaming industry is using neurological research to hook kids, is that right?
Can
you say
are.
A bit more about that?
Yeah. No, it's an absolute fact. You know, any industry, and before I bash an industry, you know, part of successful business is recruiting professionals to get an audience for your product. And I think, unfortunately, in the industry, there's a lot of naiveness as well. I also think there's a lot of knowledge and there's a lot of purposeful propagation of false information. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we can put a whole industry in that box. But what I do know is that games are designed to hook people for a 1 to 2 year period. That is their objective. And that many, many individuals that work in the industry at higher levels will not permit their children or their grandchildren to use their own products.
Hmm. And we're not talking about young children who are, you know, all the games that are, because there's a huge wave of marketing also around learning games, mm-hmm. educational games. Tell us your take on that.
Again, it really, really depends. I'm going to start with the positive. Arguably, there is no better way to teach a primary school math. But in terms of teaching any type of language skills, almost everything has been debunked. A lot of studies are out there saying programs, for example, that are designed to teach vocabulary actually do the exact opposite. You have reduction in acquisition. So really look at, you know, fact versus fiction, fact versus promotion. I'm going to digress a little bit and talk about, it's an example that's actually in the book in terms of educational games, and I think it's one that really, really clarifies in black and white. Most people are familiar with matching games, this is where you have three objects and a child is asked to pick a fourth object. And the example that I use is three pink squares, and the child is asked, three yellow squares. Let me get this right. So three yellow squares. And the child is asked to pick the fourth in the set, and their choice is a pink square or a banana. The child picks the banana and is told they're wrong. Okay, now there are a lot of things that are upsetting about this. First is there's a right, wrong, win-lose polarization, okay? The other is the child is not given any opportunity to give or explore alternate thought. So there are many things that this child could have been thinking, but they are limited by what the programmer mm-hmm. says mm-hmm. is right or wrong. So it's polarizing thinking and not getting into, you know, the larger question of whether things are probable, possible, and true scientific inquiry. So just to give you examples of what kids can come up with, well, the obvious is color, you know, mm-hmm. three yellow squares and a banana. They're all yellow. Okay. Mm-hmm. The other is, you know, that they were all banana flavored candies and the pink mint didn't taste the same. You know, if you really look at what kids come up with, it's fascinating. And sometimes they might come up with things that are absolutely out of the blue and make no sense whatsoever. You have a giggle and you move mm-hmm. on. But the issue with the majority of quote-unquote educational gaming is it boxes children's thinking. It quashes creativity, creative thought, mm-hmm. innovation, and silly fun.
Right. And sorry, go ahead.
I suggest we take a couple-minute break for our music and come back to this fascinating conversation. We're talking to Dr. Mary Swingle, who talks about, you call it stream-based technology. I call it a screen-based technology. Anything that has a screen that is presenting some information, especially for to young children, and what effect it has on their brain. Let's continue this conversation in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Conscious Living Radio on Co-op Radio Station 100.5 FM.
I'm Tasha Sims.
I'm Andrew Resmer.
And we're speaking with Dr. Mari Swingle. Fascinating conversation about how the overusage of digital devices and screening and computers is impacting both the brain, behaviors, and our social relationships. We're going to get into more. We were talking about children and how children are impacted. And I know you wanted to bring in just a little bit more of an overview to wrap that up around balancing all these.
Yeah, I don't want this all to be dark. Mm-hmm. I've already said this on this show that, you know, we can't blame it all on iTech. And there are some absolutely magnificent applications to the technology. It is, as you said, it's all a matter of balance. And if gaming, for example, is one of the things that your children do, it's arguably rather innocuous. So, for example, if going back to the book, I have an example of two little boys or young men, if they, you know, play a game for an hour and then go out and ride their bikes together, shoot some hoops, come back home, bug their sisters, and, you know, just create chaos like young boys do.
They're supposed to.
Then there's absolutely nothing wrong with gaming together. And, you know, arguably it's just part of modern life. But if two boys, you know, play multiplayer games online, have no other social interaction, are not involved in any arts or sports, and I'm not talking about the commercial aspect where parents are going nuts driving their kids to everything. That's a whole other issue.
You mean but playing.
But if they don't have any other outside interests and their whole world is gaming, that's where you have issues.
Mm-hmm. Or TV. It doesn't have to be game. Anything that is streamed, where they're purely receiving it, there is no engagement, there is no interaction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what are we losing? Are we losing the art of being intimate? Are we losing even knowing how to have deep relationships?
I'm going to bet pretty dramatic here. We are arguably losing everything that makes a culture. Hmm. Okay. So I don't know what you want to go with first in terms of this. Do you have a preference?
Well, relationship in general. Let's start with, let's go dating.
Okay. Well, first of all, dating is now online.
Totally.
And if you, you know, look at, you know, standing in line in a coffee shop, if the fella or the gal behind you says hi, you treat them like they're a total weirdo. Okay. And then you go home and you're all online and we all complain that, oh, gee, it's really hard to meet people and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that kind of irony. The other is it's completely affecting pair bonding. And if you don't have pair bonding, there's no chance for a relationship to be successful. So what is pair bonding? Essentially, you have to put enough time in a relationship to bond to somebody to see if this is something you want to pursue.
Mm-hmm. And five texts. It does not cut it, because that's what I'm seeing.
Well, that's people a whole do, other one.
Well, yeah. They do, even with online dating, you mm-hmm. go off the site, then they move to text, and they think they're getting to know you by texting.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything more ludicrous. There's not even tone. It's not even a telephone.
Yeah, the only way to really get to know somebody is face-to-face, heart-to-heart. And again, if you look at the internet dating phenomenon, if you chat and flirt and sext and cyber sex and, you know, or even just chat and have non-sexual conversations, let's just say 2 weeks to 3 months, and then you meet the person, many people are, there's nothing here. And we talk about chemical attraction or whatnot, that you get that face-to-face, heart-to-heart. Again, we can build all kinds of illusions and delusions by just communicating via screens or text. The other component is what we call disinhibition. And this was coined earlier by a group, I think it was led by DeMonaco, but essentially it came out of the studies in cyber sex. And what this is we act differently behind screens and behind words. We develop alter egos. There's a fun part of this in that it gives us an opportunity to explore aspects of personality that we never would dare to explore. But there's a real negative of this in the, you know, the negative alter ego. And the rules of engagement on screens are entirely different. We're nastier. We troll, we say nasty things, and yeah, I think we should really look into what this is doing. We're significantly more brazen as well. If we look at adolescence, you know, two kids can't look each other in the eye and say hello, and yet they're doing fierce sexting. And then, of course, they're engaging physically based on a screen relationship. And then after sexual acts, have nothing to say to each other. So we're in an interesting transition, to say the least. But to get back to pair bonding, mm-hmm. Again, the issue is the more. And it's just part of human nature that if there is the opportunity for more, we're going to pursue it. And the catch, again, with online dating is there's always the potential for more. And if somebody does go on a date with someone and they feel good about it, I think we have to kind of chat about boundaries and, you know, do you go off your internet dating site? Do you give time? How many dates do you give to someone where you don't look at others or don't chat with others? Because that's the only way relationships are going to stand a chance of blooming.
Yeah. No, a friend of mine was on a date and then they started seeing each other. And then she realized that after they would make love, he would go in the bathroom and check his profile to see if any new emails had come in from other people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you're talking about. That's an addiction, right? And we're moving into the realm of addiction.
Well, there's definitely addiction. But unfortunately, this is much more common than you think. And in terms of status quo of behaviors that youth, and I would say, perhaps I'm giving my own age away here, that what people under 30 accept of each other in relationships is entirely different. I don't mind disclosing my age. I'm going to be 50 this year. And my generation in the Western world is probably the last generation of females that knows what the pursuit is. And what I mean by that is males courting females. Now, I'm not talking about the sickness of Dumbledore and predatory behavior, but I'm talking about females now are the pursuers. They're offering more and more whether it's sexual acts to be accepted or to have males intrigued by them. If you look at the way young females dress, we blamed a lot of this on the music industry, but in fact it had a lot to do with the iTech industry, and essentially the systematic viewing of pornography after 2008, when people didn't have to pay for it anymore, changed many males' arousal templates, meaning they were not looking at females or pursuing females to the same degree that they were before. And that is what changed females' pursuit patterns themselves and what changed dressing habits. Now, people can talk about the equality of the sexes and things like that, but there's also basic biology here. And that's a whole other conversation in terms of what is right or wrong. But I think my conservative side is going to come out that sex on a platter, I don't think is ever a healthy thing. I think sharing of intimacy and the willful sharing of your body with another is a very, very beautiful thing, don't get me wrong, but the offering of such for social acceptance or to stay in the game, I think has a totally different and very negative dimension.
Mm-hmm. And there's another aspect that we kind of touched on, but haven't explored deeply yet enough for me, is this exchanging information through either text or emails, where we use smiley faces or other emotional images to express how we feel. And the reality is, when people, those same people meet, they don't know how to recognize real actual emotions.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomena. I apologize to the author if I have the name wrong. I think it's Chatfield. But he was writing some interesting stuff, a very, very pro text talk in the new language of youth. You know, that this is a new depth of language, whether it's the twist of phrases, changes, subtle changes of letters, using caps or not. And it's the language of youth and language for the eyes. Great. But as you pointed out, Andrew, there's a different side to this in that it also seems to affect our ability to actually read text. And to paraphrase a little bit, it's we need stage direction now on our writing. Mm-hmm. Part of also, if I can get into this, is the writing skills, the emotive writing skills, we're losing them. And there's lots and lots of misinterpretation of text and brief messages that are happening, again, associated with anxiety disorders and people getting into panics because of misinterpretations. Mm-hmm. Versus when we scribed versus text, I'm going to digress a little bit. When we scribe, a thought has to be completely completed before we put it on paper. And that's just the tool, essentially, because, yeah, you can scratch out. But essentially, when you write, you write. The idea is formed. So the length of time from thought to paper is longer. When we write on screens, we just purge. And then we go back and we edit. So essentially we're processing on the screen. But there's a little twist to this. If it's on a computer screen, we might give it a little bit more time. But if it's on our phones, we just throw out the immediate and send. So there's no emotional filter, either on the sender or the receiver. It's very, very different.
Mm-hmm. And then still this when the interaction has happened through texts, I think you mentioned that earlier, that the people have really hard time to actually see and recognize real emotions and read faces and behaviors and postures and what it actually means, because they have not been exposed to that.
Yeah, very true. And I'm going to talk a little bit about adolescence. If anybody looks at their own adolescence, and I'm referring to more mature adults, We all remember it was an extremely, extremely awkward phase. And I joke, I talk about how we were all, you know, puppies growing into our feet. We're meant to go through that awkwardness. And what we're seeing now is youth is bridging that phase with digital communication. So essentially, they're not learning to grow up through those awkward phases. And essentially, they miss that developmental phase.
Yeah.
I can't blame them. I mean, it's the perfect tool for it. I mean, quite frankly, if I had been 13 in this age, I would have been doing the same thing. It's a whole lot easier. But the catch is, if you do this at 13, at 23, your communication is compromised. And at 35, you know, 40, et cetera. So people just aren't, they're losing the ability to communicate meaningfully face-to-face and heart-to-heart. The other thing we're also seeing is anxieties develop. So when people do try and communicate face-to-face, heart-to-heart, there are, you know, palpitations and mini panics in that communication, as opposed to, you know, accepting silences and pauses and thoughts to come out more naturally and progressively. Times are changing in a really, really interesting way.
I think, too, you kids learn about what relationship looks like through media, through social media and through film and through, you know, television or everything but themselves and their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you think the impact of all that is in their future marriages? Because my understanding is that divorce rates, infidelity, things like that are on the rise. Is that true?
It's huge. Let me just backtrack a little bit. You know, when television first came out, you watched a little TV. There's nothing wrong with a little TV, or if you want to say now Netflix or whatnot. It's a nice passive brain deadening if you don't have the energy to read it. It's great. It's great to just
brain
plop
what?
On the couch. Yeah, brain deadening. Why not? You just plop on the couch and absorb a bit. We all do it. Nothing wrong with a little bit, as I love to say. But when that, we just do so much more of that to the lack of interpersonal communication and connection. That's when the messages of the media start to dominate and override the interpersonal messages. Why? Because we're not having the interpersonal messages. So essentially, we orient ourselves to the way media wants us to orient. The other, and I'm just going to jump right in and get in. You're talking about infidelity in marriages. There's a norming effect of porn, pornography, infidelity, and prostitution that we're seeing with screen-based technologies. For example, massage parlors, which are just euphemisms for prostitution houses, used to be very, very discreetly advertised and you know, back pages of newspapers. And now, just over the past 10 years or so, it's overtly advertised. Infidelity always existed. You know, numbers vary by culture and whatnot. But, you know, when you have infidelity sites, for example, Ashley Madison coming out and then progressing to advertising on radio and television, it's norming it.
Mm-hmm.
It's making it more and more accessible. And by making it more accessible, it's making it more standard. Not so long ago, people would kind of go, oh, massage parlors, versus now you'll hear, you know, folks just laughing on the radio about ha 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 going for a massage with a happy ending, and people are joking about this as if it's normative. And the sad thing is, it is a lot of males' first sexual experiences now are prostitution, and we hadn't seen that since the 40s and the 50s. So essentially, we've really, really regressed a lot. The other is young men and boys are getting a very, very early exposure and saturation through of sexuality through pornography, and they're not learning about what it means to be a man, and in that a partner, a lover, a boyfriend, potentially a husband, through their elders. They're learning through pornography and through media. Mm-hmm. And that's changing the game. The catch, of course, is young females know this, and you're seeing a lot of mimicking behavior of pornography as opposed to real sharing and giving of bodies. And again, that's changing everything. I talked earlier about what I referred to as arousal templates. And all arousal template refers to is how much you have to see, smell, touch, etc. to become aroused. And what we're noting again in males is what they have to see and touch and experience is dramatically increasing. And that's not only to be interested it's just to merely be interested. So there are some major mm-hmm. Changes going on.
Now, we only have a few more minutes, so I wonder if we can shift to our happy ending. What is it? What's your dream for the future? How do you see some positive steps that we can all take to move us in a direction that... we've been talking about a lot of really disturbing things. Mm-hmm. What can we do?
Well, shows like this. As I mentioned before, my mission is to really, really share information so people can make informed choice. It's not all bad. And I think, when anything new comes out, we have these total immersions, and we just get this, swash of everything. And I think I'm trusting over the next 3 to 5 years that we're going to see not a backlash, but a real positive digestion of information and people making some really good choices. I'm not saying go off Facebook, but some people are doing that, but to limit yourself, to an hour a day, or to say it's not bad for kids, but not after not before the age of 6. Mm-hmm. If you want to watch a little porn, by all means, but if you start to lose interest in your partner, then go, all right, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. So essentially for all of us to use our own wisdom and to listen to the voices out there that are trying to waken us up from our mesmerization with technology, and essentially to embrace all the wonderful components, but look, really open-eyed at all of the other aspects.
And tell our listeners where they can find out more, how they can reach you, find your book.
Well, shameless promotion for mm-hmm. my book. A lot is in my book. I also have a website, drmariswingle.com, which needs updating. I apologize, but there's a lot there.
Okay. Well, it's certainly been fascinating speaking with you. The book, again, iMinds. Actually, let me just hold it for a sec so I can get this very long. How cell phones, computers, gaming, and social media are changing our brains, our behavior, and the evolution of our species. That's heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's where is the book available?
Anywhere, I'm happy to say. Yeah, you can get it online, or in your bookstore.
And we'll also have information on our website, www.consciousliveringradio.org, and this interview will be on there as well.
By tomorrow. Well, thank you so much. Just 30 more seconds. Are there any lectures, workshops, or opportunities for our listeners to meet you in person and ask some questions?
The next one actually is in Portugal, so I think that's a little far away.
Well, good excuse to go there. I love Portugal.
Okay, but I do post things up on my website, so I promise I will. DrMariSwingle.com, which I promise I will update this week.
It's not that bad, Mari. Okay. It's really not.
It is. There's lots of good information there.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so
My
much.
Pleasure again.
You've been listening to Conscious Living Radio, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, 100.5 FM.
See you next week, 6 to 7 on Wednesday.